Testing for sound. That's all I need. Thank you.
It's 1:20. It is Monday, February the 13th, and present for the record, we have Representative Wilson, Gruenberg, Cott, Anderson, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and we have the following items on the agenda today. We're going to start with the Ethics Committee public member confirmations. There are three individuals today. And then we're going to go to House Bill 353, Sentencing for Sexual Offenses. We have Representative Newman here, and we have the Department of Corrections. And I had asked Department of Corrections to give us a presentation on the polygraphing part of it. We're going to do just that part today, and then House Bill 353 and the Senate companion are going to be merged together on Wednesday. So we won't start marking up the sexual offenses bill until Wednesday. My hope is we can mark it up on Wednesday and vote on it on Friday. In fact, please, can we do that so that we can get it marching on its way? And so if you've got amendments, if you've got things, start putting them together. And then we're going to go to House Bill 400, Confiscation of Firearms, and House Bill 384, Fines and Offenses. So that's our agenda today. And as I stated on the floor on Wednesday's agenda, my apology, my committee aide is super efficient, and she was getting everything together. We still haven't reached an agreement on one of the bills that was put on Wednesday's agenda. So instead, what we'll be doing, the new calendar will reflect House Bill 353 first, slash its Senate companion, which I don't know the number right now, and then Senate Bill 20. Okay.
Just to report, we had an informal subcommittee meeting on Senate Bill 20 Saturday.
Oh, good.
Afternoon, and we got briefed on it, and we are now going to be talking about that at some point when the majority leader can do it.
Great. Okay, and so Representative Gruenberg, any comments on Wednesday that you want to make about that would be great. You know, any insight you want to give us. That's the subcommittee. Okay, so without further ado, we'll take Ms. Lindsay Holmes, who's here. She's here in person, so we'll take her. Tell us why on earth you would want to be on the Ethics Committee as a public member.
Thank you.
Glad you qualified.
Good afternoon. My name is Lindsay Holmes. Why on earth would I want to be on the Ethics Subcommittee? I grew up in a household where it was very much a part of our everyday lives that you were involved in the committee, in the community that you lived in. My parents were extremely involved in their communities in Anchorage. I was born and raised in Anchorage. And my mother was actually one of the original members of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And I received a call about a month ago from the Chief Justice asking me if I would serve on this committee. And I began investigating, and it just seemed like a very good way to be involved in government, to be involved in my community. I think it's very important for people to trust the system, and I think it's very important for you as legislators and for your staff to also trust that you have a fair process, and that the rules are clear, and that you have, when there are questions, that you have a group that you can come to that you can trust to help you find the answers.
Fabulous. One of the things I'll just put on the record, I don't want to take too much time today, but I want to put it on the record so that it's something that you continue to think about in your service, should you be confirmed, which I think you likely will, as a public member of the Ethics Committee. And probably you've been filled in, but this committee in particular has spent a lot of time working on the structure and the procedures that go into the Ethics Committee. We've made some modifications here and there. A bill, Representative Norm Roepberg, had made some changes. But really, what I want to just kind of equate you with is that this committee has had a lot of, I think, oral input into it. And some deep concerns that sprang out of one of the Ethics Committee's hearings back in 2002, and really highlighting the process to us. And so I guess want to say, one, that I think I can't emphasize how important I think the Ethics Committee is. I think it's absolutely important. that members of the public feel comforted that there is something out there, you know, looking at the legislature, because we are our own bosses. And in some senses, that can create at least the appearance to the public that maybe we're not always in their court. And so I think it's important that there's a venue to really vet concerns that the public might have about improprieties that they perceive. That being said, so I think it's very important. I think in order to really preserve the functioning of the Ethics Committee and all of that, I think that it's important that the procedures that are used have an eye toward due process, have an eye toward fairness and transparency. And one of the concerns, you know, that we had was in that hearing that came up in 2002, it was clear that, you know, you had some conflicts of interest that were occurring, and you had some situations where a person who might be brought before that committee may not feel like they were getting a fair shake. And I know that the committee has continued to look at that. They took our concerns very seriously. And I want to say thank you to the committee for that, and to the committee staff for that, for listening to the concerns of this body and this committee. But I think it's a work in progress. I don't know that we're 100% there. And so I think it's, you know, I think you have to, as a public member, I would hope that you could view it also as being in the shoes of someone who might be brought before your committee. What type of fairness would you expect that individual to have? And in our courtrooms, we have, you know, these huge volumes of court rules that assure that that person, no matter how bad of a person we may think they are, that that person will be treated fairly in our state. And so these are quasi-criminal proceedings the way I view them. They're very serious. And even just making an ethical accusation against somebody can be a political death sentence for them. It can be an economic death sentence for them. And so I hope that you will hold in your hands very gently those lives and realize that should they have done something wrong, they ought to be punished. But give them that fairness that I think we ought to be giving anybody that comes before your committee. So those are just my comments. Representative Anderson.
I would just say thank you for your service, and you have a really impressive resume, obviously, that U of C and the Stanford in terms of degrees, but having worked for Heller, Ehrman, White, McAuliffe, I'm a friend of Hal Brown's, and
okay.
I think he was probably there before you were there, and Ashburn, Mason, Julian Mason, all those folks are great.
Did you mention Willamette?
She didn't go to Willamette.
Oh, sorry.
I can, and Willamette's a great college too. Thank you.
Wonderful college.
And you're in Rotary and Chamber. And I mean, what's nice is you have a really broad. You should run for office. But anyway, really impressive.
Thank you.
Anybody else, Representative Conkill? Questions?
First of all, sorry for being late.
Oh, it's okay. You're busy.
Conflicting duties. So. Thank you for being willing to serve. We do live in interesting times. Mostly what we do in the arena of the ethics is civil related. I don't know that the public generally is aware of that. And so much of our remedy, if there's false accusation, is criminal. And I've talked with some of the staff about this. And so it's just to kind of reinforce what the chairman has said that I think the public need to have a place where if they feel that there's a bad action going on, that they have a place to hold people accountable. But recognizing that if it's a policy disagreement rather than inappropriate behavior, I would hate to see that committee being used for that. Many of us have felt the sting of that. You don't want to throttle down the freedom of the press. But you also want to make sure it's properly reported. And so as we go through any deliberative process down here, we just try to keep that in perspective. And so, I guess for all three, I would say that. Just be aware that many times, even in children's law, we treat people in a civil code, but it's really criminal issues we're dealing with, and they don't get charged until later. And we did that so that we could reach over and protect somebody quickly. public does need to have protection quickly from bad actors, I suppose, but if the only remedy is criminal defense, it gets really tricky. So I think many, many times we've crossed between civil and criminal in many areas of law, and I'm not too sure if we've done right. So it's just an area, a question, and I would ask you just a question as you go down through that. And I thank you for your service.
Thank you.
And with your background, too, just extending on Representative Coghill's points as well, it was reported back to us, and Herman Walker's on the line, and Skip, who've been through the whole story with this committee, so they know, maybe they can give us more of a report, but one of the things we had asked the committee to do as well is to, we recognize that the rules of the court are not going to apply, but there are principles contained in the rules of court, as I stated earlier, that I think describe the type of fairness and the type of balance that we'd like to see. And the bill that Representative Roekberg passed, for example, prior to that bill, Brent Cole, who it's not about Brent Cole, he's the person that's the attorney now, it could be anybody that followed him, would be in a position to be the private counsel and the informing counsel for the committee to sort of walk them through the process and go over the record and so on. And then suddenly, at the very end, the way the process was set up, he would turn and serve as the prosecutor for the very person whose lives is in your hand. And you can see, I think, the inherent, even appearance, if not reality, of the conflict of that. And so that was one of the things that we've changed legislatively. But what I would hope that the committee would do is really continue to be proactive. And to the extent that you see places where there could be more fairness, there could be rules adopted, there could be a structure, a procedural structure put into place that would, you know, get to the truth of the matter while protecting that person's rights and the interested public member who's brought the concern, I encourage you to you know, continue to go forward in that vein. So. Okay, any further questions?
Nope. Anybody who could serve with the rest of that on rest of us on that committee deserves to be confirmed.
Yes. And that's right. Representative Grover is on this.
Could you please speak into the mic?
That goes for you, too, guys on the line.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify in this candidate's confirmation or online? Okay, hearing none, then I'd appreciate a motion.
I think Representative Newman
wants to.
Oh, Representative Newman.
For the record, my name is Representative Mark Newman. This time I'm just testifying on myself, for myself, as I got the opportunity to work with Lindsay up in Fairbanks at the Conference of Alaskans. She was always willing to participate in all the discussions, have an open mind on both sides of the issue, which I felt was very important, and found her to be one of the more exemplary members of the committee. And in that behalf, I fully recommend that
that's fabulous
that you approve her confirmation on this hearing.
Thank you, Representative Newman.
Madam Chair.
What a delight. Representative Grunberg.
Do you want to take a motion on each one of these?
Yes,
after
please. Individually.
I move that we forward the name of Lindsay S. Holm to the full House for a vote.
Is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, Lindsay Holm's name is forwarded on to the full body for consideration of her membership on the Ethics Committee.
You survived the gauntlet.
It wasn't that bad. Okay, and so next we have Mr. Herman Walker. Mr. Walker, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, tell us why you want to continue to serve on the Ethics Committee.
I enjoy my time on Ethics Committee. I think it's been very beneficial and enlightening as to how the legislature works. I feel it's a commitment to put back into the community in this form. I think the Ethics Committee, I'm going to echo Lindsay's statement that it's a very, very important, and actually I'll echo Madam Chair's statement that it's a very important role that this committee plays is, in dealing with the legislature, and having public input in that role I think is very important. So those are some of the reasons why I chose to stay on.
That's great. Do you still own the Body Shop in Fifth Avenue Mall?
I sure do. Going, just had our 10th year.
I love it. I'm glad to know the owner. It's one of my favorite stores. Just teasing. Okay, any questions of Mr. Walker? Representative?
I smell jasmine.
I love it. Okay, anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on confirmation hearing of Herman Gene Walker, Jr.?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
I would. I've known Mr. Walker for a long time, both before he before I took my seat on the committee and afterwards, and he has served as the chair for most of the time I've been on it. I found him to be a very fair chair, run a good meeting, have an open mind, and look at things judicially.
Thank you. Okay, with that, a motion, Representative Anderson?
I move that we forward Herman Gene Walker's name on the, Ethics Committee Board member confirmation to be heard before the full body of the House.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Hearing none, the name of Mr. Herman Walker will be forwarded on to the full body for confirmation. Thank you, Mr. Walker, for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Dennis Cook.
Yes, I'm here in Fairbanks.
Great. How's the weather?
Very mild. It's close to 30 degrees and sunny.
You better put your sunscreen on.
Denali was gorgeous this morning as I drove in.
Great. Okay, so tell us why you want to continue to serve on the Ethics Committee.
Well, just a word about tenure. We've had a fair amount of turnover on the committee, and I guess right at the moment I'm the longest tenured person there. Some of the other members have encouraged me to stay because they have felt that it's important to have some continuity. So that's one factor. I really feel the work of the committee is important. If we have very fascinating questions come before us, fairly complex because the statute's complex and not easy to work your way through. One of the things that I feel is a purpose of the committee, we do kind of three things. The office of the committee gives informal advice when a legislator or legislative staff member has a question about what's appropriate. They can seek some advance advice as to that. We have advisory opinions, which are a more formal form of that. The informal advice, by the way, is reviewed by the committee. We get reports as to informal advice given, and then by the staff, and if we feel that it was inappropriate or needs to be changed, we can certainly do that. The advisory opinions are a more formal process that we all participate in, and then of course there are the adjudications when there's a complaint before the committee. I really think the first two functions are very important, along with the training function of the committee. Each session, at the beginning of the session, the staff, along with committee members, presents a training session for legislative personnel as to the act, and has lots of good examples and scenarios to discuss with the staff. So I really feel that training plus the advisory opinions and the informal advice designed to avoid the complaints that we get are really the most important work of the committee. And I'd like to be a part of that process. So I feel strongly about ethics and ethical matters and have enjoyed serving and am certainly willing to continue.
Mr. Cook, questions for Mr. Cook? Representative Guerra.
Mr. Cook, I just want to thank actually all of the folks who are applying online. I just want to thank everybody for their service. It's really important that we have an ethics committee. I think it's an amazing commitment that you guys put forth by doing this, and it's probably thankless or even worse sometimes, so I appreciate it. Madam Chair, is it a three-year appointment? Is that?
Yes.
Thank you. I've got no other questions. Thanks.
Okay. Motion? Representative?
Well, I'd like to test
it. Representative Gruenberg.
Again, I have served with Mr. Cook since I took my seat on the committee a year ago. And I found him to be of exemplary character and a very valuable member of the committee on Joint Committee on Legislative Ethics, and highly recommend him. He's an excellent attorney, and he too acts judicially and fairly, and I recommend him.
Motion? You want to make the motion, Representative Garrett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the nomination of Dennis Skip Cook to remain on the Ethics Committee onto the floor.
Full body, yes.
To the full body for consideration with recommendations.
Recommendations. Is there an objection? Okay, hearing none, Dennis Skip Cook's name will be forwarded on to the full body for consideration. Thank you, Mr. Cook. Representative Groenberg.
Yes. I would ask the chair, as the sponsoring committee, to see if, or I guess maybe we can talk to the majority leader himself. You bring these up, don't you, on the floor?
I do.
Because we, until these people are confirmed, we lack a quorum and we can't conduct business. And I know we have Joyce Anderson here with us. I guess she can answer any questions, but we would like, when are we planning to have our next meeting, Ms. Anderson?
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, whenever we have a quorum.
So it would help if we could get these folks confirmed.
Just technically on the motion.
Representative Garrett?
I think that's a motion without recommendation. I don't think we do recommendations on forwarding a nomination to the floor.
Right. That's right.
You can object to the nomination.
Yeah, you can make your recommendation, I guess, on the floor. Yeah.
And just a comment, Madam Chair, not with regard to timing, but I suppose that because the trickiness of many of the things that are discussed in Ethics Committee, it's important to have attorneys, but I don't know that it's absolutely necessary, is it? Okay, I just wanted to make a note for all of you attorneys, and since I'm not an attorney, that sometimes the topic can spin into the legalese of criminality before you step back and look at the broad scope of just common sense ethics. So I'm just putting my plea in, since I'm not one of the bar associated members.
Yeah, we have Ann Rabinowitz on the committee now. Mary Ann Stillner is not seeking reappointment.
It's a good point.
Notice.
From a public perspective. Yeah,
and as we go down the road, and I don't know if we're going to modify any of these standings, but I understand that I would be interested in seeing us rotate the seated members so that we didn't have to have so many coming up all at once. So quorums then would be a little more easier to assemble. Yeah. So, and we may or may not see that this year, but I'm open to that discussion.
Yeah.
And in opening that discussion, I will probably ask, as a policy matter, do we want to fill it with attorneys, and or it, what is the balance?
Yeah.
And I'll just be asking that question.
Madam Chair, maybe Ms. Anderson could at least address the first of your questions very briefly. We have talked about that. We're revising our procedures. And could Ms. Anderson come up briefly and to introduce herself and answer the questions?
Hi, I'm Joyce Anderson, Administrator to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. And yes, we have in committee talked about changing the terms of office. Right now we have three public members whose terms are up, which means that we don't have a quorum, because out of the five public members, we need three for a quorum. And so we're hoping that possibly this year, and I know I've had some discussions with Representative Coghill about it already, that we could get that language changed so that we could go back and we'd have staggered terms. We'd have two, two, and then one, so that we would not have three at one time, which puts us in a disadvantage because, as Representative Groenberg said, we're unable to meet.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Okay. Thank you, all of the folks, for your public service on the Ethics Committee. I echo Representative Guerra's comments, and thank you for your commitment to public service. Okay. Next, we have House Bill 353. And as I said before, we're just going to hear from Portia today. And so, welcome, Mrs. Parker. And I apologize, I did call you Babcock last time. I'm usually really good about it, but then every once in a while I look at you and just slip. So, sorry.
No problem.
Okay, so tell us about the polygraphing.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Portia Parker, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Previously, the chairman had asked that I give a brief presentation overview similar to the presentation that was given last year to this committee, which was much longer and more in-depth. But I hope to concentrate here, go over quickly some of the statistics that bring us to this bill being presented to the legislature, but then go right into both what we're doing currently with our containment model project, as well as the benefits of the use of the polygraph in treatment and supervision, and standards, regulations, and quality control issues about how we plan to implement it, as well as what we're doing right now and kind of where we are in implementing after the pass, the included in the budget last year of a pilot project to start the containment model in Anchorage.
Yeah.
So to begin with, this handout here has been provided. It's a little bit scaled down of what was presented last year. It starts off with the basic statistics I think you're all familiar with sexual assault and rape. That one of the interestings here in the U.S. Department of Justice study was that 45% of state prisoners participating in a 1991 study said they committed the crime while they were on probation and parole, while they were currently on probation and parole for another
what
crime.
Was that percent again?
45%.
So it contained in these slides is basically we're going to cover the need for specialized sex offender management practices, that rape victims don't report the crime, and that containment model.
Sorry, Representative Guerra.
I can reserve my questions for the end or as we go on, whatever you'd like.
Doesn't matter to me. What would you like, Mrs. Parker?
It's probably easier to do it as we go, I think.
Portia, the 45% statistic, that's do we have a statistic for how well we do with our probation system in Alaska, or do we just have the federal statistic?
We do not collect that data in a central location for Alaska. What I can do and what we have done is that we can pull how many times our whole group of prisoners or just sex offenders, how many times they've been booked in, how many times they've been convicted, how many PTRPs have been, you know, issued on that person, whether for parole or probation violations.
Okay.
The containment model, the goal is information and public safety, what we can learn from sex offenders, particularly by use of the polygraph and treatment, how we use the polygraph examination, that treatment and polygraph enhance, specially used together, enhance public safety, and quality control measures. These first ones I'll go through quickly. Alaska has twice the national average of rape per capita. We have one for...
That's a terrible stat. Is there a range to that? Is there going to be something in here that says, because there are some that are probably very egregious, some where people had consensual and then decided it wasn't. And so I was just wondering what the range is here.
This is actually a forcible rape.
It is?
Yes. Okay. So that is not, that's not contact, that's not attempted.
This is the violent.
This is a forcible rape.
Representative Guerra?
Just while you're here, I've got to admit, the most compelling thing to me for an area of policy change has been that you hear statistics about how few or how many sexual assaults go uninvestigated at, like, the Anchorage Police Department. Is it something like 30% or 40% go uninvestigated at the Anchorage Police Department?
I do not have statistics for APD, but what, as a general rule, both in Alaska and in other jurisdictions, is a very small percent are reported, and of those, a small percent are investigated, and of those, even a smaller percent are actually convicted.
Still number one.
Yes, by a lot.
But I would like us to do better on that point. more than almost anything else.
Reportable rapes increased 21.7%, or I should say reported increased 21%. Reported rapes in Alaska increased 21.7% from 2000 to 2003. And although these are still greatly underreported, there were 521 reported forcible rapes and 54 reported attempted rapes in 2003.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Coghill.
This is just amazing to me. I don't know how I missed all these stats before, but I know we've talked about this. So was there something that happened in Alaska that we think brought 21%? Or is this a continuing rise from past history? Are we on the same continual rise? Or
are people just finally reporting it?
I think that.
There are several scenarios, I think. The one that I think that we believe is leading to increase in reporting is education, advocacy groups, the knowledge more people are feeling comfortable coming forward and reporting. And I think that's an education process. Sometimes it's increased law enforcement efforts in a certain area that may not have had much law enforcement. But what we've seen is an increase in the people feeling a little more comfortable reporting it as a crime.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
I'm just going to toss this out because I can't do it on my own, but a few of us have said this in the past, I think members of both parties, but that a big part of the solution has to be more law enforcement officers and prosecutorial resources in this area, and it costs money, but it's... Do we know anybody on the Finance Committee? It's just, it's been an issue. We talk about it every year. And there are things, you know, we can always change the sentences, but if we're not changing the number of cases that are being investigated, we're missing the boat.
I've spoken of this before. When my dad retired as the head of the troopers in 83, he said that since that date, we talk often, he said the number of troopers are, and not just because there's brown shirt versus blue shirt versus VPSO, it's half. And he says, I don't know how they can do it, you know, investigations properly, efficiently, with results, with only half the manpower and woman power that they had back then. I mean, I agree with you. It's scary. That's 23 years ago. Portia's like, I agree. What do you want me to say, Portia says? Jeez.
In fairness, there was appropriation last year for 4 trooper positions that could not be filled this year. So
it's another part of the equation. Yeah.
I mean, that's a part of the issue.
And corrections folks, too.
This is one area where I think with the polygraph, the use of the polygraph with and treatment and supervision in the field really helps, because you find out so much information about crimes that have been committed, what are the relapse, how these offenders slip into relapse, how many victims they've really already had, and we share that information with law enforcement. And it's been, especially in the state of Oregon, this sharing of information has prevented a number of assaults just by law enforcement knowing that someone's being released, here's their assault pattern, and they see a crime occur, they knew right away who had committed that crime. And it sped up the investigation, although it didn't prevent that rape. A woman was assaulted by this offender. But by sharing the information, the probation officer and the treatment provider immediately knew, pointed law enforcement in the right direction of someone who does the same thing every time they assault someone. And so in some ways it can assist law enforcement. In other ways, it helps offenders not commit new crimes, because it's a check on their behavior. And some people, it'll just help us catch them faster. Some of them just aren't motivated to change. The next statistic is also scary on the social costs of sexual assault, which more than half of the victims have been raped more than once, 6 times more likely to develop PTSD, 3 times more likely to develop major depression, and 13 times more likely to attempt suicide. That doesn't get into the drug and alcohol abuse. That's also extremely high. Alaska's cost of victimization, just taking the 521 that were reported, times 86,500. That's an estimate from the National Institute of Justice of the overall cost to help the victim and the law enforcement, the social services, the addictions, all the other costs that go into providing services for the victims is about $45 million a year for Alaska. And then that, the Rape in America study, which is the most comprehensive study on sexual assault that was done in 1992, this is where, and most of the other studies that have been done are in the same range, between 15 and 18% of victims report the rape.
So, Madam
Chair. Representative Cockhill.
We just put a bunch of money in the last few years into going around talking about suicide rate. This must be then one of the larger segments of the suicide population. If it's 13 times more likely to, we got 500 youngsters or people that are being raped.
Mm-hmm.
This is amazing. So have you worked with that that group at all, compiling your statistics with their study?
No, most of these studies are national, but they're the similar findings.
Have they come and talked to you about suicide and rape in Alaska?
No, not directly. No.
So we need to make that nexus. We need to connect to.
I do believe that though they don't talk with me directly, but I do believe they work with our providers in our department, who are more of the line staff who deal with these issues day in and day out with our probation officers, treatment providers, mental health clinicians, and are those who are providing more of the health services, both for victims as well as offenders.
Okay.
Who reports or who doesn't report? Younger age of the victim and knowing the perpetrator are the least likely to report the crime or have a delayed disclosure of the crime. Those who have their life threatened, physical injury, or they have a stranger perpetrator are more likely to report the crime. And then here's where we get into the arrest rates of that 16%. So if you take 100% of sexual assaults, 16% are reported. Of that 16%, only 27% result in an arrest. So we're getting to a very, very tiny, tiny portion of those who have committed sexual assault. And this is one reason why the sex offender recidivism rates are so low. They're artificially low. And one of the findings, especially with children, when you're talking about sexual abuse of a minor, is incest or those who assault from a position of trust, the victim is even less likely to report if it happens again because of what they went through the first time. The trauma to their families and to them, that they said that they just wouldn't do it. They'd rather put up with the sexual abuse than report it again. So,
may I inquire?
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Ms. Parker, has anybody ever asked why and what we can do, but that we haven't done, to make it more comfortable for them to tell the truth? I'm not trying to get them or pressure them into testifying against somebody if it's not true. I want them to be comfortable in telling the truth, whatever that may be.
Representative Grunberg, I think it's more of a fear of what overall society will think, what their family thinks, how they're treated by their family members, their relatives, the other parent, their siblings. Not at least in the studies that I've read, it's not so much the fear of law enforcement or the state agencies that they dealt with, but just the overall being blamed themselves for the offense. And I'm not sure how you make that more comfortable.
I'm not either. And I think it'd be worth our society, because it's not an Alaska problem, it's a national problem. And I'll bet, gee, in these Muslim countries and stuff where they go and they stone the woman for things, I'll bet it's even worse in some of those countries. But I certainly think that, we seem to have, when we deal with crime bills. We make things tougher by increasing sentences, generally, or creating new crimes. It's less often that we try to do something, and I guess the victims' rights legislation was in this area, but to encourage people positively to, in this case, do the right thing and I mean, I could say, well, why don't we make it a crime to harass the victim afterwards? And you know, there have been enough movies of that. And they're always sad. I sure would like to know if anybody has had any luck in doing something positive with the pre-trial rehabilitation and maybe the post-trial rehabilitation. Do you know of anything that's been done or anybody around here who can help us deal with that in a positive manner?
I do not have information on that specifically. The corrections doesn't specifically work with victims except for information and help them through the process. But as far as providing treatment and services to victims of sexual assault, that's not a service that we provide.
I understand. You're the wrong person. Madam Chair, are we going to be having anybody besides Ms. Parker here today on this bill? Okay, well, I see Ms. Parks is here, probably on another bill, but maybe when somebody from law testifies on this bill.
On Wednesday, we're going to do the markup of the bill, so that'll be the day law is going to testify, and we'll get into
it. I would like
to
know what we can do to make things more comfortable for the alleged victim. And I'm not sure how we do it, but I'm certainly open to suggestions.
Yes. I'm with Alaska now. I work on domestic violence and sexual assault, and we represent victim programs.
You have to, in the mic.
Do you want to?
We're taped, so.
I don't know if you'd want me to do this or my boss to do it on Wednesday, but I'm Chris Ashenbrenner, for the record, with Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We're a member program nonprofit of 20 member programs across the state that are domestic violence sexual assault programs. And so we are victim representatives, and we work directly with many victims. And I'm not sure what your question is, but I thought I might be able to to get some insight.
If you could look over Ms. Parker's shoulder there and see the statistics here, and I think that we want to start with the page that has a stoplight on it there. 27% of reported sex crimes resulted in an arrest. And then the next page, if you turn to that, now this is recidivism rates here. I thought this was conviction rates, but it's recidivisms.
10th page in.
Yeah, okay, well, I'm concerned about the people who are reluctant to come forward because of the stigma, the skepticism, because of the low self-esteem people have after they've been sexually assaulted. Am I going too slowly?
I wanted to get through this, but
okay.
Hurry it up.
I would just, through the chair, I'd recommend you always have deliberation, which I like, and thoughtfulness. But conversely, we have three other bills, and we're going to get to this Wednesday, and it's a really good PowerPoint that you're asking to be reiterated for the record, which is appreciated, but we can read it.
No, I just want to know what we can do, and we can save this for whatever you want. But I'd like to get the question answered. If you'd rather answer it on Wednesday, that's okay, too, Ms. Ashenbrenner.
Or if you want to come by Representative Gruenberg's office.
I'd like to have it on the record.
If you have a brief statement to prepare on the record on Wednesday, that's fine. But what we're doing on Wednesday, we all know there's a problem, and we can keep discussing it. But on Wednesday, we're going to mark up the bill and then bring it back up again on Friday. So that's the schedule.
Would you like me to prepare some information to address those questions on Wednesday?
To be distributed. That would be great. Thank
Certainly.
You.
And Representatives Guerin, Newman, and Coghill have committed to work with Representative Groomberg tonight from 7 till 11 this evening on this issue. So thank
that
you.
That would be fabulous. Anything that you can get us for the record would be great.
And
thank you.
Any questions that you have between now and then, give us a call.
Great.
That's my question.
Thank you. Okay, and then, Portia, let's try to get through this as quick as we can, knowing that we have the copy of it here. The only reason I wanted this PowerPoint into the record and just a brief part of it because I felt that members needed their memories refreshed, but we do have two other bills and I don't want to take the whole hearing on it. So, okay.
So we were talking about delayed disclosure, that children particularly fear being disbelieved, punished, or unprotected, and that this is a huge number of the victims. Often 50 to 70% are children, 17 years or younger. Those are the, and in Alaska, that's very high. Sexual abuse of a minor is often the crime in sexual assault. Adult victims, 71% concerned about the family knowing, others knowing, and about being blamed by others. The goal of containment is to obtain and share information. I think the slide, the containment approach, policies, the polygraph with treatment, with the criminal justice system, which is primarily the probation parole officer, and setting all of these different components are part of containment. They're all going to be part of the Alaska's containment model, which we are modeling after Oregon's and Colorado's programs. And that the most important part of making sure that things stay in check is the consequences, and the criminal justice system provides that hammer, the probation officer, the parole board, and the judge. So failed polygraphs, the sanctions must be immediate, linked to the risk, include increased surveillance, corroborative information. I think a lot of people are concerned that we will not and do not revoke based on a polygraph, a deceptive polygraph. The information has to be, you have to get corroborative information, you have to verify, and right now we have the teams of the treatment provider, the probation officers, and the polygraph examiner all working together and sharing that information, and each person on an individual basis and how they're doing, and it is a team decision.
Representative Kira.
This is the most important question for me on the bill, on the polygraph provision. I understand the value of using the polygraph as a hammer over the head and as a way to get information to follow up. You know, maybe you'll find out there's a victim and you have to go protect the victim right away. I understand that part. I'm suspicious of polygraphs. And I know they wouldn't be used in a court hearing, but are they used in the probation revocation hearing, or are they not used there either?
We don't cite the polygraph, deceptive polygraph, as the reason for revocation. We get independent verification or evidence that something occurred. We may have been tipped off to it.
Sure, that's fine. The polygraph tips right. you off, but at the hearing itself, you're not using the polygraph?
Correct.
Okay, and that would remain the same under the terms of the bill?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Good question.
The next couple pages are just very shocking, startling information about what we find out through treatment, and then adding in the polygraph second and third compared to what's available in criminal justice records. I mean, you go from two victims to 184. And the information just grows and grows and grows until the offender becomes... I'm sorry. I don't know why. I don't have page numbers on this one here.
It's midway through.
Excuse
green
me.
And blue.
Secrets Revealed.
Is it after this stuff?
Secrets Revealed is the headline.
Oh, it's back there.
Wow. And they're becoming more and more studies as they use the polygraph in treatment, and it is used in 38 other jurisdictions. And it's growing the use throughout the United States. Matter of fact, we have a lot of other providers in other areas that want to use it for managing other criminal behavior to find out whether people are letting them know what there's really happening and they're complying with their conditions. But we are only proposing to use this with sex offenders because it is been the most valuable tool with sex offenders than anything else that has been used or any other tool in the field and in with treatment and in community supervision. One of the most startling things here that we're learning through the use of polygraph throughout the states where it's being used in Texas, Vermont, Connecticut, Florida, Washington, Colorado, California, is that the traditional a rapist only has a certain type of people that they assault, and they prefer females of this certain age. And what through the use of the polygraph with treatment, they're finding that that's not the case. That the crossover is much more extensive than ever thought 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And one here that is the most startling for treatment providers when they've seen this and they've talked with us about this is that having adult and child victims, and according to court records, only 7% had adult and child victims. After the polygraph, 70% had both adult and child victims. And this is particularly important with the criminal justice system and for probation parole because of reuniting with children and family becomes difficult if you don't know if they've assaulted children. And also, just you think that they're safe around children, or this just gives us a lot more information about what we're facing. And incest is also one of those one of the crimes where it has supposedly has the lowest recidivism rate, but we also know that children who are victims of incest are the ones most likely to say they would never report it again. Even if it started happening again, they're never going to report it again because of what they went through the first time. And also here you can see that they also 35% assaulted strangers of people who were convicted of incest, 57% assaulted from position of trust, and 36% also assaulted adult victims. Average age of onset, and this is fairly consistent with most of the studies in the United States and elsewhere, is somewhere between the age of 12 and 16 or 17 is when offenders start offending. And the lag time in detection is also pretty high from the first time the offender commits a sexual assault to the first time they're caught or arrested and prosecuted for the assault.
Are you able to find out, and it may not be in here, and I don't want to take too much time, but are we finding out why at all? Is there information that can be obtained that helps in the future in terms of prevention and treatment? Is it that they've been abused themselves? Is it that they come from, broken homes? Is there anything? Are we looking at that data too?
Certainly. And I think through the risk assessment process and the treatment process, that's where you get a lot of that information. Past history, childhood. There's such a broad range of offenders here. So, there's a very low-risk offenders. They're your offenders who repeat the crime a lot, but it's not particularly extremely, does a lot of damage, like a forcible rape compared to, an assault where the person can't control their behavior, they have other mental disabilities, or are not fully functional. That is, you have this wide spectrum, and some are psychopaths who like to torture their victims and or even kill them, to the person who just can't quite control their impulses, has poor impulse control. And this is on the huge range.
I just want to put on the record too that one of the things we always try to look at, I think, in our correction system is, is not just the punishment part and the retribution part, but to try to really get at the root of it, to rehabilitate where you can. But I think I'm hoping this tool can be used for broader purposes to find out in Alaska, 12 years old and you're starting to assault other people. What has led up to that? I guess everybody has their different views, but I'm saying, we've all failed when a 12-year-old is doing that. And it's not that they shouldn't take responsibility for their actions, but what are we as a state and as a society failing at that has this tremendous rate of rape and molestation, and that these young people are really at an age where they're barely out of sixth grade or they're in sixth grade? and they're perpetrating this type of behavior. It's amazing to me, and I'm hoping that in addition to preventing future crimes and to helping kind of keep these folks contained and to protect society, because many of them are well on the path that they're going to be on forever, that we can try to use it as a tool to figure out how people end up in this place in the first place and what it is that we might be able to do better at. So I want that on the record too. Sure. Representative Guerra?
On that point, largely, as I recall, when the administration came in its first year, they ended in-prison sex offender treatment programs. And that's probably too blanket of a statement, but can you tell me what programs were ended and what was put in their place? I think it was felony convictions.
It was one program at the Highland Mountain, Meadow Creek, and it was a very small program that was only able to take minimum and low-medium custody offenders, which is unfortunate. But most of the offenders who went through that program were those who were motivated, who were more amenable to treatment. And the program treated about 10% of sex offenders. So we had 90% of offenders were not getting any treatment. So, and of those who went through, we had a four-year study. Of those, the 4 years of the sex offender treatment program, 38 completed the program. So we evaluated how much money was being spent, about $500,000 a year, on a certain number of offenders, how many were completing. We were getting a benefit from how many risk assessments and other, even partial going through the program, definitely has benefits. But the overall cost of the program for those offenders who were eventually going through, who were the low-risk offenders who could be treated in the community, that we put those resources, one of the things we did last year was put the resources into community treatment, where we have more providers, where we had offenders getting out anyway with no treatment at all, who were higher risk, and we were able to provide more treatment in the community and better services to more offenders.
So they weren't receiving treatment until they got out in the community?
That's true, and they're not now.
This could take I brought it up, and yeah. But it could take days, but it's just something to keep in the back of our minds.
And one point I'd like to make is that most sex offenders were not sexually assaulted as children. It's about 25 to 30% were, so 65 to 70% were not. They may have been abused or beaten or assaulted in their childhood, but most people who are sexually assaulted do not become sex offenders themselves.
Okay, and then keep communicating with me, because, I mean, is it a matter of a line item or something that would, or a direction from the legislature that would say that as you're going through with the polygraph program and you're looking at its effectiveness and you're implementing it in Alaska, what would it take to be assessing all the way along who these people are anonymously? Who are they? Where do they come from? What if any can we identify as patterns?
One thing we're doing right now is we've started a risk assessment program where we are working to have an in-depth risk assessment done on every sex offender prior to release. We're doing that while they're incarcerated.
Okay.
So that when they get out, they go to their treatment provider, they already have the in-depth risk assessment. We have two sex offender treatment providers on contract who are traveling to the areas where most sex offenders are housed and doing those risk assessments pre-release. And that was not being done several years ago. We're almost caught up on those.
Just on that, I would hope that as you're going through your risk assessment and through your questioning, and I just went and I flipped through the back of the book to see if I could find out anything. Just like we deal with methamphetamine today in one area, I think internet pornography is probably that equivalent. And you've got to be seeing much of this behavior as a result of some of that activity. I've seen it in the church I go to. I've seen it in friends that have been caught up in it. And then they do behaviors that are absolutely wrong. So, and this statistic shocks me, but I see the correlation very clearly. So are you measuring that?
We are, as far as the impact of internet use, it certainly is makes it easier for offenders to have access. The access to victims, access to materials, it's making it just easier. But making easier for people to engage in behavior that they have a tendency to do anyway.
Well, that's what I meant. But under the scenario we live today, compared to when they had to go to a movie theater or a bookstore, now there's open access, probably no accountability, and addiction. Probably from what I've understood, not unlike some of the alcohol or drug related addictions. So when you get to that, then the acting out becomes criminal, just like you do trying to steal for your drugs. And so it's just that you dehumanize people and then you go treat them less than human. And so all I'm asking is, are you measuring that to any degree?
I don't believe that we are measuring. Obviously, we have statistics on whether they were committed of a crime involving the internet. Whether rates go up and what's that directly attributed to, that's a little more difficult for us.
I was just thinking, because you're asking them behaviors that led up to, and if that's not in, if that's not part of your question, you're missing a big question.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. No, we do. Absolutely, we ask that question. And what we have is an extensive questionnaire that each offender has to fill out that talks about internet use, access, how do they find victims, how do they groom their victims, you know, every behavior they could possibly be involved in, pretty much.
I didn't see that, and so I thought it seemed to me that with just the little bit that I've seen in my life of those who have either been lured on the internet or those who are addicted to the pornography on the internet, they have had that kind of a problem. So I just didn't see it, and I'm thinking there's got to be a correlation here.
And the next step is for us to be able to actually catalog all this with each offender, and then what they do in other states is you enter that directly into the criminal justice database so that it's on file with that offender if that offender is out and then gets arrested again. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm trying to speed up here. Okay, I'm not sure if you need me to go through how the polygraph works. I think that most people know that. Fear detection.
We did, yep.
Polygraph, okay. And accuracy, certainly the post-conviction polygraph with sex offenders is one of the most accurate polygraphs because it is very controlled, very specific, short, four control questions, extremely limited, no intent questions, no, did this happen? Are you doing this specific thing? So it's a lot more accurate in that sense. And we get most of the information through the pre- and post-interview, not during the polygraph. The different types of exams, sex history exam, I won't go into all reading. Then we have the specific issue exam, which is one that would be used in probation parole. So-and-so saw the offender at this location in violation of their condition? We ask them, were you at this location on this day? And so those are the specific issue. Monitoring is finding out if they're engaging in prohibited behaviors, are they starting to relapse so that we can intervene, keep them back on into compliance with probation parole. See if they're applying what they're learning in treatment and making sure that they aren't engaging in high risk behavior. Let's see. Polygraph is a good deterrent. In Colorado, the supervision with polygraph, 69% of those sex offenders in the program were successful in compliance with probation. Without polygraph, 26% were compliant with probation conditions. This goes into more of the questions, the mental state, no mental state questions, no intent questions. I've already gone over that. We're adopting the similar standards that Colorado has, that the polygraph examiner must have graduated from an APA-accredited polygraph school, minimum 150 criminal issue exams, minimum 50 clinical exams in 12-month period, and 40 hours of specialized training every 3 years. We are in the process of developing procedures. We are working with our therapists to educate them about how the process works, what will be the demands on them, how it will change, working with the probation officers and the polygraph examiners. Most of our treatment providers are actually very excited about using polygraph as a tool in treatment. Some are hesitant, as we would expect, but we have several who have been wanting to do this for a long time and are very excited about being able to add it, and they're going to add it and use it even in with their clients who are not on probation, parole, or who are not being paid for by the state, just in their own adopting it into their own treatment. And we'll also be requiring it eventually as a condition of being an approved provider providing sex offender treatment. We will videotape all exams so that there's a record of what was said, that there was no coercion, that all the procedures were followed. We'll be collecting data and doing quality control. Let's see, going to the end. Polygraph testing should never be used in isolation. Multiple methods should always be used. Polygraph plus treatment equals more information than polygraph or treatment alone. And basically, the goal here of treatment and polygraph and the whole containment model is more information, offenders become more successful and in completing their probation parole, as well as hopefully for the rest of their lives, and some will need to stay in treatment for a very long time. But the ultimate goal is public safety. It takes a lot of training. We have put a lot of effort and resources into training our staff, policymakers, the criminal justice system. We're doing that again in April. We're going to be inviting judges and public defenders and DAs and treatment providers, people who work in housing, health and social services, to walk them through the whole process, explain what we're doing, what protocols we're putting in place, how this is a team process, and the more information you share, the better it is for everybody, for sharing with other agencies. And we've set in some measures. We're going to be reporting back to the legislature after the program's been in place, and report back our findings and also our own, what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong, and seeing if there are ways we can improve it.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Parker.
Thank you.
Okay. And will you be here Wednesday?
Yes.
Okay. We'll bring it back up. Thank you, Representative Newman. Representative Newman has a... Did you want to address the committee? Representative Newman.
Representative Mark Newman, sponsor of House Bill 373, that looks at this. We've compiled an extensive information packet of information of research. It's more than an inch thick. Any questions that this committee may have, we'll be glad if you could provide those with me. I will get you an answer. I think, in a nutshell, we can look at this and say, as Representative Coghill had asked, just why does this happen? And I think a lot of that has to do with I think that there's a thought process of, well, I can get away with this, you know, and I really want to send a strong message out there to the public that Alaska will not put up with this. We're only one of eight states left to enact Jessica's Law legislation, and I really want to make a strong statement to the public about the importance of this issue. Bring it forward, talk about it. As disgusting of an issue as it is, the longer that I've been involved in this, the more angry I get about it, but we do need to address this and make sure that the people are aware of what's going on. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Newman. Okay, we are going to go to House Bill number 400 by Representative Coghill.
It's my bill.
It's your bill. And we've got a CS in front of us. It is version F. And so I'd appreciate a motion. Representative Cott, you want to?
Madam Chair, you move that we adopt CS for House Bill 400. Version F, lockup 2906 is the working document.
Is there an objection to adopting that as our working document? Okay, hearing none, we have version F before us. Representative Coghill, tell us, are you going to present your bill?
Yeah, I'll start off, but I'm going to ask if I could have Ms. Karen Lidster sit up here.
Yeah, Karen, why don't you come forward?
For me. The the simple part of this bill was my part. The more complex part is going to be her part. The simple part is during the Katrina disasters down there in Louisiana, it became apparent that keeping law and order was important, but it also became apparent that the law enforcement and those charged with that enforcement weren't able to protect everybody, and yet they were confiscating arms, and I thought that's wrong. So I think in those particular circumstances, unless there's a compelling reason to hold and take those arms, I want to make it a prohibition. So I wanted to make it, I wanted to consider the public policy of saying you can't just go take arms from law-abiding citizens. If there's other reasons that could fit into probable cause, I'm game. The question I have probably is if the felony is the right answer. I put in Class A felony. I wanted to say if you're going to take a constitutional right and disregard it, that it should be a high penalty. So that's the public policy question I'm asking. I think that keeping order in times of disaster is important, so I'm not saying we should let disorder rule, but I am saying that there are times when the government can't protect you and they shouldn't take your right to protect yourself away. And then, quite frankly, to me, the Second Amendment rights quite often are there so that you can protect yourself against your government. You know, so there's a fine balance. And so what I'm trying to do is say the citizens have the right unless they have somehow done something to forfeit that right. And if you're going to forfeit their right, it's going to be at a cost. And so that's the simple part of the bill. And I would defer some of the questions because, unfortunately, during the time that I'm supposed to be studying this, I was having to manage other things. So I'll ask Ms. Karen Lidster if she could talk to you about why the difference in the CS.
Okay.
And go from there.
And Ms. Lidster, when you're addressing the committee, lawfully owned, I think, is clearly recognized. Law-abiding citizen, I've never seen that term in a bill, and I don't know if that's defined somewhere. When you're addressing the committee, I'd love to hear that part. We get the point, but is it better to say lawfully owned, possessed, or carried from someone who is not committing crimes, or citizen who's not in the process of committing a crime, or something like that? Anyway, I just wanted to know where you got it, law-abiding citizen.
For the record, my name is Karen Lidster, and I am staff to Representative John Coghill. And specifically, the question that you have asked, Madam Chair, I had a conversation and got a very good perspective from Representative Gruenberg, and his concern was that the bill was a little too broad, that there would be a problem with the police being able to come in and there's an altercation of some type going on or some misuse of a firearm, and need to have it a little bit narrower, that we're not talking about people that are doing unlawful or illegal acts with their firearm. I did put in at the request when I sent over and told Ledge Legal I needed to make sure that it was understood that this was not a person committing a crime or in the process of doing something illegal, and we ended up with law-abiding citizen.
Anything further? I think that the differences are clear, but if you want to put them into the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we see in Section 1, 2623-200, Section 2623 deals with all the powers and responsibilities and authority that the governor and his assigns are giving in a disaster. And when you get to Section 200, there are certain things that limit that authority. And We have added on in that section that it's limiting the authorizing of confiscation of legally owned firearms, lawfully owned, possessed, or carried firearms by the law-abiding citizens. We went further to then amend it by making the new section to read confiscation of firearms and what the person knowingly attempts to do or orders confiscation of during a disaster emergency, what they would be guilty of and what that penalty would be. And I can answer any questions
from the committee. Representative Guerra?
Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out what language would be appropriate to make sure you don't take a firearm away from somebody who isn't a threat to do anything wrong with the firearm, and the case where law enforcement fears that somebody is going to use a firearm and therefore needs to take it away, use it in a to commit a crime. And I'm just thinking out loud, one thing you can do is say it's a defense to this crime if you take the firearm with reasonable suspicion that the person's about to do something, commit a crime with it. And I don't know how reasonable suspicion, what level of proof that is. Maybe that's 50% certainty, I don't know. But what if a law enforcement officer has like a 25% certainty hunch that somebody's about to use it, that somebody's going to use a gun to kill somebody? Would threatening them with a felony prevent them from acting on the hunch? And I don't know what kind of language we can come up with to make sure that the law enforcement can protect the public on one hand, but not be deterred for fear of committing a crime from protecting the public on the other. And I understand the concern that's motivated the bill, but I want to make sure that we're not hampering proper law enforcement activities.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's probably a good point, and I see where you want to make sure that law enforcement is, you know, feels that they see something that they are suspect of. And I could speak with the Department of Law and just see initially when I did speak with them, they were quite, I think if I can use the right term, just neutral about this, felt that it was not something that they wanted to even comment on. But I can speak with them about that specifically, sir.
I think this speaks pretty narrowly to what the governor's going to be able to do under emergency. But I think if there is a reasonable suspicion of foul play under those conditions, I think they're going to have some authority anyway. So whether it be they give a direct order and an order is totally ignored, where, you know, let's clear this area, this is unsafe, and somebody decides that they're going to inappropriately use a firearm, at that point, it's not just reasonable suspicion. It's, you know, I think you already have those types of things in play. So I don't know that we can envision every circumstance here, but I would be careful of trying to define that unless we miss something. So if you have even just a traffic violation, you have to have probable cause, don't you, in order to assert your authority. Am I wrong?
I think we could answer the question with somebody from the Department of Law or the public defenders. I think normally you need let's say in an investigation case, you need to meet a certain standard before you can get a search warrant, and it's something like probable cause. But there are times where the court says, "But this is an emergency. The law enforcement has to do this right away. They don't have time to get a search warrant, and maybe the standard shouldn't be as high because it's an emergency." And I'd like to find out what the standard is that's applied in the normal criminal context in the cases of an emergency, and see what that threshold is, and maybe that's the appropriate threshold to put in here. You know, because sometimes in the criminal law you don't have time to get a search warrant because you need to stop a murder right away. You need to stop a rape right away. You've gotten a tip. And I think there's an easier standard to meet or a way around the search warrant requirement in those emergency situations. And those are the situations I'm thinking about here. But
do we have anyone here from Department of Law or online? Do you want to testify?
Captain Story online.
Oh, Captain Story, are you there?
Yes, I am online.
Are you following the discussion?
I have been, yes.
Do you have anything to...
Well, I think from a law enforcement point of view, there's a couple of things that have already been alluded to, and maybe I can expand on it a little bit. Are those kinds of situations that happened during Hurricane Katrina potentially could happen here in a large disaster, is that you certainly have property owners that want to defend their property and should have the right to do that. But you also have people who are out there maybe wanting to take that property or take advantage of the situation, or maybe are having emotional issues because of the stress placed upon them, or maybe maybe they just typically have emotional issues, or a myriad of other reasons why a person may harm themselves. And you know, and under those circumstances like Katrina, where there's such a breakdown in public process, as the law enforcement agencies have to have the ability to try and referee that instead. So I can envision where you have an emotionally disturbed person with a weapon that law enforcement may not want them to have that weapon, or you may have people who are, for lack of a better way of paraphrasing it, or phrasing it rather, are just bullies, or they're trying to take people's property in spite of the lawfully abiding person trying to defend their property. And sometimes you just gotta take control of the situation to make sure that it doesn't spin out of control. So I certainly agree with the spirit of the bill, if there could be some sideboards that are established that allow law enforcement some discretion to deal with those things that we can't even begin to imagine until it happens. And I'm not sure, I couldn't even offer a suggestion on what that language would be, but I think from a law enforcement point of view, we have to have some ability to work within that situation.
Representative Crocco.
And I'm sure willing to look at whatever sideboards. At this point, I haven't been able to find out how to do that. I'll tell you why, because quite frankly, I think sometimes the government can be just as much a bad actor as other marauders. We had a policeman who stepped over the line a couple times during that. So the stress is equal on both sides. And I don't know that going in and confiscating arms is really the answer to that as far as a blanket approach. So the rule of our government still has to stand strong, and that is, you know, your right to keep and bear arms. And for the very same reason that if you have a breakdown in law enforcement or in society generally, you know, the government can't protect you. Other people want to harm you. You need the right to protect yourself. So if I put a sideboard on here that says that you have to give deference to the police force, if the police become bad actors, I'm not too sure I'm going to go down that road with them. So, I mean, we saw a little bit of both just this year. And then to have somebody make a blanket policy that it's just too dangerous for us to go in there and create order, so we're gonna create martial law and confiscate everybody's arms and everything. I don't know that's a situation I'm willing to go into at this point for a disaster. There might be other reasons you might want to do that. So I'm open to discussion on sideboards. I'm sensitive to that balance, that's all, Madam Chair. And I think that if somebody is being a bad actor to the point where they are going to perpetrate criminal activity, you have many laws on the books already that would give you reason to hold them. But if they are not being a bad actor, but just for the purpose that you want to confiscate their arms, they become a bad actor, I think the government steps too far. And so I think we already have enough criminal law and civil law on the books to say if they're going to be aggressive and and a problem to society or a danger to society or themselves, I think we already have enough law on the books. And it is true that it's a disaster situation, but to then take away their only means of maybe self-preservation and then leave them without remedy after that strips them of their right, number one, as a citizen, but leaves them vulnerable to their life. So, you know, so I thought this narrowly approaches one subject, and that is you can't take them from a law-abiding citizen. If they're not law-abiding, take them on.
Representative Guerra?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I do think we need to get somebody with some criminal experience to let us know what the standards are in the emergency situation under existing criminal law. But I'm thinking of Representative Coghill, you could be a law enforcement officer, you could see somebody who is a law-abiding citizen technically, but who you fear is about to become a non-law-abiding citizen. You take the gun away from him while he's a law-abiding citizen because he hasn't committed the crime yet, but your fear is that he's going to use the gun on somebody an hour from now. And so I think the way the statute's worded right now, you're taking it away from a law-abiding citizen, even though you have a legitimate fear that he's soon going to be not a law-abiding citizen. I know you don't want to hamper law enforcement in that situation, but I think we have to come up with language that says you're not liable in it. You don't go to jail if you take it away from a law-abiding citizen who's about to shoot somebody.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Crockett?
Just in the spirit of discussion here, that could be true now in any circumstance. You could fear that somebody would do something wrong. And there have been times where police have actually tailgated people, followed them because of that. But until they can see some movement towards criminal activity, unless they have other probable cause to stop them, they're going to have a problem on their hands. So here we have a situation where it's more intense, probably. And now you're going to have a policeman making a judgment call of what could happen and wants to violate what would be a constitutional basis in law for their freedom based on a judgment call, a supposition. I think that's dangerous ground.
Okay. I don't have a problem. The bill goes to finance next. I have one more person to testify. Representative Guerra, you should explore that with Department of Law. I think my hunch is that, in the end, the two of you will likely still disagree, but I don't know that. I mean, meaning you could probably come up with a series of exceptions that would address your point exactly, but I think you can see what the original bill looked like, I mean, meaning it had no exceptions at all, and now it at least has a law-abiding citizen in it. And it appears to me like that's as far as the sponsor is going to go. But you know, it's the department isn't here now. But I assume they could come up with something that would answer those concerns. I just don't know where, and then where the sponsor would be. But I have one more person, and then I want to get to the next bill. Representative Kruenberg.
Yeah, I have, Madam Chair. I have some of the same concerns Representative Guerra had. And I talked with Ms. Lidster at some length, and I focused on the, quote, law-abiding, and I'm very glad they put that in. The problem is that in the State Affairs Committee, when we were briefed by the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs on emergency services, the disaster preparedness, most of them now involve villages and flooding. And these villages, many of them have no law because the VPSOs have been defunded. The only people who come in is an occasional trooper. And it's much like a Texas Ranger going in to a place where there's no other law. And there's total chaos. The place is flooding. There may be alcohol problems. And now the man or woman are going to be facing a Class A felony if they take a gun away from somebody when they may not know whether that person is law-abiding or not. They may be in terrific danger.
Here's what I'll do. I'm going to hear from Brian Judy, and then I'll hold the bill over until Wednesday. I do that if there are concerns from members as a courtesy. So that will give you more time to look to legal and see whether or not you can work out. I don't know if the sponsor is going to be amenable or not, but at least then we'll have an amendment and an opportunity to discuss it and vote on it. I don't disagree with the comments.
One other thing I have not said very much so far. That if you're concerned about a person taking a gun away, how about the person who gets arrested, detained, maybe required to stay away from a certain area, may lose their home because they can't go back in. The police, the militia, in a case of a disaster, have got to have the authority to keep the order. This is the bottom line when civilization's about to crumble.
Okay, thank you, Representative Grunberg. Brian Judy?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Judy.
Members of the committee, my name is Brian Judy, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the National Rifle Association, and I urge your support for House Bill 400. As has been discussed, the recent events in New Orleans during the aftermath of the hurricane demonstrate quite clearly that the right to keep our arms is very important during a state of emergency. And the very basis of the Second Amendment is the empowerment of individuals with the right to provide self-protection. And when is self-protection more critical than during a time of disaster when law enforcement resources are stretched beyond their limits? This bill would protect law-abiding Alaska citizens from experiencing the blatant violation of their rights that occurred in New Orleans. And in fact, in that situation, there was none of this lack of clarity. It was just a clear case of government officials inappropriately taking people's property, their firearms. And the NRA was forced to file a lawsuit to stop the egregious violation of the rights of people who were only trying to protect their families and property. And this bill would clarify that lawfully owned, possessed, or carried firearms cannot be seized, and then it would make accountable for their actions persons who knowingly confiscate a lawfully possessed firearm from a law-abiding citizen. Now, with respect to the question that have come up with regard to what's a law-abiding citizen, in my mind, that amendment is really unnecessary because the language of the bill as introduced refers to lawfully owned, possessed, or carried firearms. So if they're lawfully owned, possessed, or carried, then the person obviously is a law-abiding citizen. And with respect to the question of the person who may become person who's not lawfully owning, possessing, or carrying, off the top of my head, I'm not sure how to answer that question. But what I do know is that that's not what this bill is trying to get at, and that's not what happened in New Orleans. What happened in New Orleans was just an egregious violation of constitutional rights, and I know that that's what this bill is attempting to address. And with that, I urge your support for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Judy. Questions for Mr. Judy, Representative Grunberg, and then Guerra?
Mr. Judy, this is Max Grunberg. I grew up in San Francisco. In 1906, there was a little earthquake and a fire, and much of the city was in a blaze. Now, how is a law enforcement official or a militia person going to know in a situation like that, or in New Orleans, or a Pompeii where a volcano is exploding, who exactly is law-abiding and not? The power is out. Their lives are in danger. And my question is, whom should the law protect in that situation? Would you want to be a law enforcement official going into that situation if you couldn't protect yourself and disarm somebody if you thought there might be a danger to you? Would you want to volunteer and go in that circumstance without the right to do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunberg, I think that the issue is the vast majority of government officials are responsible and are not going to commit the type of violations that were committed in New Orleans by a small
tiny percentage. And what this bill is targeting is that small percentage of government officials that I think Representative Coghill described quite well as maybe these weren't his words exactly, but they're overzealous and they're not taking proper calculation of the risk. Because we're not talking about, you know, what happened in New Orleans, what you're referring to. You know, what happened there was just egregious violation of rights where people who were just trying to protect their families and their properties had their guns taken because they possessed guns. There was no concern. There was no threat of risk.
Okay. May I? Briefly.
Representative Kronberg.
Mr. Judy, the problem is in the how this thing will play out. The person you're criminalizing is the law enforcement official with a Class A felony. And how can they make that split-second decision that may be essential to protect the lives and property of everybody in the neighborhood if they're faced with a Class A felony?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Groomberg, maybe a Class A felony is not the appropriate level of crime, but it seems that there needs to be some accountability. And again, it's for a person who knowingly confiscates a lawfully owned possessor carried firearm. And again, you know, Representative Guerra was asking for somebody with criminal experience, and I will say I don't have that, so I cannot necessarily address the question, but I know under existing law that law enforcement has, you know, a certain level of authority with probable cause to take certain actions. And I believe that if there was appropriate probable cause, then they would be okay. And you know, any case of this type would have to obviously go to court, and you're going to have the whole fact pattern of the case. And I think if a law enforcement officer or government official came in and had the probable cause, then there's not going to be a problem. But if there is no probable cause and he knowingly took a firearm just because he didn't like firearms or for whatever reason, then there's going to have to be the accountability. And like I said, maybe Class A felony is too steep. That's a decision for the committee and the legislature to determine.
Representative Guerra? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Judy, for your testimony. We'll bring the bill back up first thing Wednesday. So if there are any of the arguments that have been thrown out there, if people could put them in writing in the form of amendments.
Yeah, my concern, Madam Chair.
Representative Groenberg?
I sympathize with the person whose rights are violated. I sympathize, frankly, more with the person who's got to go in and clean up the mess. I'm not sure how you balance that. Tough cases make tough law.
Okay, so 400 is set aside, and we'll bring it back up first thing Wednesday. And without further ado, we have House Bill 384, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we have, just for the record, we have Cliff Stone here from the Department of Public Safety as the legislative liaison, and we have Lieutenant Todd Sharp with the Alaska State Troopers in the committee room, and then online we have Captain Al Story also with the Alaska State Troopers. House Bill 384 essentially proposes a raise on the maximum amount a person may be fined to $750 when found guilty of an infraction or a violation as currently provided in statute. And it's kind of a hodgepodge throughout the statutes to raise these levels, with the exception found in Section 2 of the bill that sets $750 as the minimum fine, with the amount of $1,000 established as a cap for that type of offense. In addition, the bill will bring fish and game penalty language in Title 16 into alignment with the current statutory definition for a Class A misdemeanor. And the history here is Back in 2002, the Alaska legislature doubled the fines for Class A misdemeanors from $5,000 to $10,000. However, several important Title 16 penalties listed a maximum fine of $5,000 and thus remain locked at that level. So it's a housekeeping bill. This increase in the dollar amount is consistent with today's values and begins to allow for inflation since 1978. A lot of these haven't been changed since then. The increase in the maximum monetary penalty will serve as a further deterrence, in our opinion, ours meaning myself and Department of Public Safety, to those not only found guilty, but for those contemplating any action that might lead to such an infraction or violation under the law. In today's society, the most serious infractions and violations are the types of offenses that the public observes daily. The public expects that enforcement action will be taken to ensure our collective safety. By increasing the fines levied against those that are found guilty, we act to serve the better good. Two amendments were recommended.
And I forgot about the CS, too.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get to that. I just want to give the introduction of the general spirit of the bill. I would move for discussion purposes the adoption before us of House Bill 384, version Y, which has some more changes, Title 16 changes.
Okay, so version Y is the current version of the bill. Is there an objection to adopting that for discussion purposes? Okay, hearing none, we have version Y before us.
So, Madam Chair, that's basically a general analysis of the bill. Obviously, I haven't gone through section by section because it would be too, I think, take up too much time, and it's fairly broad. But Cliff and Lieutenant and Captain online, they can answer questions. I think they'll endorse it first and then maybe stand by for questions.
Okay. Lieutenant Sharp.
Yeah, Lieutenant Sharp of the State Troopers, Madam Chair. The State Troopers do support House Bill 384, and we've been appreciate Representative Anderson bringing this forward. We've been trying to get infractions and violations in line for a couple of years and bring them in and get some consistency between the two. I think that a couple of years ago when the violations were brought to $500 in 2002, somehow there was some oversight or what have you for Title 28 being left out in that venue.
Questions? Representative Kara?
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, I understand the intention to move all the $500 fines up to $750, and that seems fine, but I'm just looking really quickly through the first two sections, mm-hmm. and they seem to reduce what's now a crime to just a violation.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on there? What is that?
To the Chair, Representative Guerra, I would defer to the Department of Public Safety and either Cliff or the Captain Story. They were basically the ones that helped me craft this.
They did it?
Cliff?
I won't say that. It was their idea, though. You think I know this?
Madam Chair, my name is Cliff Stone, Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Public Safety. I will probably defer to Captain Story, but as the bill drafter went through the bill, we were particularly interested in Title 28. But as the bill drafter went through the bill, he found other inconsistencies in state statute all the way down through the various titles. And this one struck him as being inconsistent with this particular Title II, and I have to tell you, I'm not completely knowledgeable of Title II, so I'm hoping Captain Story, if you're still online, Captain, if you can go to the specifics of that question.
For the record, this is Al Story, Captain of the State Troopers, working on the Director's staff here at Headquarters Troopers. This is Section 1 and Section 2 are statutes that are not specifically tied to the Department of Public Safety, but in my discussion with people that have been involved in drafting the bill, the discussions were that if it was a misdemeanor that is capped at $500, in effect what you're doing is you're making it a violation by putting that cap on it in its old language, so why not call it what it is, and in fact it is a violation because of the monetary cap that's been put on it. Hopefully that answers the question.
This is Representative Garrett. I'm not even sure what these crimes are, but if the legislature determined that it's conduct bad enough to be a crime, then it comes with possible jail time. And by turning it into a violation, you've now eliminated the chance of any jail time. So I guess though I'm still, I don't know, just looking at the numbers of these statutes, I can't tell what the crimes are for.
And I apologize. I can grab the statute book here and perhaps answer that through the chair. But I think it's the intent of the original language that there was no jail time, that there was simply a fine. And I believe the drafters were hoping to correct that by calling it a violation as opposed to a misdemeanor with only a $500 fine.
And, Representative Greer, this is Chairman Anderson, while Representative McGuire is out of the committee room. And when he states drafters, I think he means Ledge Legal Services. So I wish they were here, but we didn't anticipate questions. But to that question from Representative Guerra, Representative Gruenberg, did you have a comment?
Yeah. This is a really important bill. We're going to go all through the statutes here. And I would hope that if we take one of two approaches, And you know I respect you a lot.
Of course.
I want to help do the right thing here.
Of course.
But either we've got to spend real time in these areas, and this is under the first two sections caught my eye. Apparently it's in the Uniform Air Licensing Act, which comes from territorial law, unchanged from 1949. There's one thing that was a couple things that were changed, but most of it's not. And these deal with the display of licenses and permits. The statute itself that we're amending only covers a couple of things. It's it covers 090 is that you must exhibit the license or permit on request. 110 requires that there be emergency equipment carried on this. And that's a life safety thing, and you're making that only a violation. I think that we have to either do one of two things, Mr. Chair. Either we're going to have some substantial testimony on some of these or strike them from the bill, because if they're not carrying emergency rations and equipment on an aircraft, people will die. And I'm not going to make that subject to a violation of a $500 fine. That's probably something that should be strengthened. And I'm just looking at those things. And we, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I think that the members of the committee should be given copies of the statutes involved in the acts or bring their books so that we can carefully go through this. This is almost a reviser's statute. And I've had Deneen, who's sitting here back, her fingers are bleeding from going through the books. very concerned about some of this stuff.
Madam Chair, you've returned. Representative Gruber makes a good point, which I anticipated, that the committee members, certain committee members, would want to go line by line through every single change. And so I didn't think we could move this bill out today. I was hoping, but
okay.
I can't answer. I can't answer 90% of the
questions. I make a suggestion.
So we'll bring it back up.
Let me finish, though.
Sorry.
Okay. But when do you think we can bring it up so it doesn't become to the classic black hole, the judiciary?
Wednesday or Friday.
Not due to your fault, but due to questions.
I don't know what you're referring to in a black hole. All of the bills in this committee have moved out.
I don't mean in terms of your chairmanship. I mean in terms of the questions that could go on for our lives and past in perpetuity.
Okay. Friday is an open day because we have scheduled all the bills in this committee through Wednesday. So Friday is open, remaining for bills to move forward and roll forward.
Okay.
So
I'd ask your indulgence to bring it up Friday, and then I'll work with Representative
Will you Grover. Be prepared by then?
Yes.
Perfect. Representative
Speaking
Grover.
Of the black hole of this committee, I think maybe, and I'd like to work with Representative Anderson and anybody else, and can we have a little subcommittee between now and then to really go through this and any, so we can look at what's going on here, because Mr. I see who the drafter is. We don't name names on this committee. We all know who it is. And just for the sake of purity, my goodness. And by the way, this is something I have been interested in for 22 years. I have long suggested that there should be a Class C misdemeanor. The Class A misdemeanor is a year in jail. Class B is 90 days. I recommend, and this may be a great vehicle to do it, we look at a Class C, which is 30 days in jail. And that may be just the kind of thing to do this, or having a violation, current violation, might be a Class B violation, and you might have a Class A violation that's $500 or something else, dollars, but just a fine. And I think we should look at this carefully and really, and I'm saying to you, Chair of
Labor
Commerce.
Yes, no, that sounds good.
That we, and I'm happy to work on this with you, whatever it takes, that we invite the various departments to come before us and really see what they think. This is a serious thing when you don't have the emergency equipment on your aircraft. And those of you,
okay, why don't we bring it back up Friday then, first up on Friday, and I noticed that Captain Story and Sarah Gilbertson are both online, and if the two of you or if you yourselves or if somebody from your department could be available Friday, then we'll work our way through. Hopefully members have a copy of it now and can be working on it between now and then to go ahead and see what the reference is. We always have bills that are big in this. This is a bigger bill, but it really is the members' responsibility to look through and see what parts of the statute it's changing. It is kind of unprecedented to ask a member, any member that brings a bill before this committee, to have the entire statute that it amends before you all the time. So between now and Friday, if members would look through it, and we'll bring it back up first thing Friday.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, yeah, I will make sure that every single section is defined so you know what's affecting. Now, I would not agree to bringing commissioners in and having my joke on the black hole was simply that it's going to delay.
For us, available on the phone or something, so that when we go through it in our working group, we can talk to these people.
A sectional analysis would be good. We could, yeah, the drafter could prepare that.
I'm just talking about dealing with it with us.
I'm shocked that that's not in there, but it's not. So I anticipated that before the meeting. So we'll have it by Friday.
Okay, so Wednesday we'll bring up the sexual assault bill again, and we'll have Senate Bill 20 in the subcommittee report and discussion. And then Friday we'll bring, House Bill 400, and then we'll bring up House Bill 384, and then the vote for the sexual assault bill won't be till Friday as well. So Friday we'll bring first up 384 and then the sexual
thank
assault
you, Madam
bill.
Chair. Very kind.
Okay, with that, thank you very much, Lieutenant. Thank you very much, Cliff. Okay, we're adjourned.